Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. The sheep that belong to me listen to my voice. These words of Jesus are not only the theme for the Gospel this Sunday, but are also particularly relevant for the 43rd World Day of Prayer for Vocations. Each and every one of us has a vocation in life, a call to find God in a unique way. However, some people find God through the priesthood, religious life, and other institutes of consecrated life. Today we remember these people in a special way and pray also for those who are trying to discern their vocation in life. In today's program, we also look at the Pope's recent activities and also first reflect on the Gospel for this Sunday with Jill Bevilacqua and Sean Patrick Levitt.
Jesus said, "My sheep hear my voice. I know them and they follow me. I give them eternal life, and they shall never perish. No one shall snatch them out of my hand. My Father is greater than all in what he has given me, and there is no snatching out of his hand. The Father and I are one."
All through the pages of the Old Testament runs the image of God as the shepherd of Israel. A homely image, familiar to the Israelites, who were an agricultural people. So when Jesus spoke of himself as shepherd and his followers as the sheep, he was not introducing a strange new idea, but developing one his listeners had grown up with. Today, with our emphasis on individualism, we tend to shun the pastoral image. Sheep, moreover, are not noted for initiative. But, as the Pope's preacher comments,
"One of the most obvious phenomena in our society is the mass syndrome. We allow ourselves to be led passively by every sort of manipulation and hidden persuasion. Other people create models of well-being and behaviour, ideals and objectives of progress, and we follow them. We eat what we're advised to eat, dress as they teach us to. We speak as we hear, in slogans. The criterion by which the majority allows itself to be guided in its choices is the 'that's the way everyone does it' of Mozart's 'Così fan tutte.'
What Christ offers," he writes, "is an experience of liberation. To belong to his flock is not to fall into the mass, but to be saved from it." Famous conversions come to mind, such as Newman's. When he became certain that he wanted to become a Catholic, he wrote to his friends that he intended to ask admission into the one fold of Christ. As for the experience of liberation, Thomas Merton wrote that once he realised he wanted to become a Catholic, "everything inside me began to sing." "My sheep hear my voice. I know them and they follow me." These words of our Lord reflect the lifestyle of the Holy Land Shepherd. He doesn't drive his flock, as our shepherds do, but walks in front of them, leading them to new pastures. "And as he goes," writes H.V. Morton, "he sometimes talks to them in a loud sing-song voice." And our traveller noticed something else, the sympathy that exists between the shepherd and his flock. And he offers an explanation.
One reason why the sheep and the shepherd are on such familiar terms in the Holy Land is that sheep are kept chiefly for wool and milk, and therefore live longer and exist together as a flock for a considerable time. Also, the shepherd spends his life with them. He's with them from their birth onwards, day and night, for even when they're driven into a cave or a sheepfold for the night, he never leaves them.
Since the Second Vatican Council introduced the three-year liturgical cycle, we have three different Gospels for what is known as Good Shepherd Sunday, all taken from chapter 10 of John. Year A covers the first 10 verses, where Jesus compares the true shepherd who enters the sheepfold through the gate with the thief who climbs in another way. And here already he speaks of the sheep hearing their shepherd's voice as he calls them one by one. They never follow a stranger. They do not recognize the voice of strangers. Jesus refers then to himself as the gate through which the sheep may go safely in and out. In year B, we're presented with the powerful image of Jesus as the good shepherd who lays down his life for his sheep, unlike the hireling who abandons them when a wolf appears. Here again, he refers to the rapport he has with his sheep. I know my own, and my own know me, just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father. In all three Gospels, the relationship between the sheep and the shepherd, and between Jesus and the Father, echo each other constantly. But whereas the first two follow directly on each other, our Gospel today comes a little later in the chapter. But before we return to it, let's listen to this extract from a letter written in the December of 1773 by the clergyman naturalist of Selborne, Gilbert White. In those leisurely days, a man of God had time to stand and stare and draw a biblical comparison.
One thing is very remarkable as to the sheep. From the westward till you get to the river Adour, all the flocks have horns and smooth white faces and white legs, and a hornless sheep is rarely to be seen. But as soon as you pass that river eastward and mount Beeding Hill, all the flocks at once become hornless, or as they call them, pole sheep. They have, moreover, black faces with a white tuft of wool on their foreheads and speckled and spotted legs, so that you would think that the flocks of Laban were pasturing on one side of the stream and the variegated breed of his son-in-law Jacob were cantoned along on the other. And this diversity holds good respectively on each side from the valley of Bramber and Beeding to the eastward and westward all the whole length of the downs. If you talk with the shepherds on this subject, they tell you that the case has been so from time immemorial, and smile at your simplicity if you ask them whether the situation of these two different breeds might not be reversed. However, an intelligent friend of mine near Chichester is determined to try the experiment, and has this autumn, at the hazard of being laughed at, introduced a parcel of black-faced hornless rams among his horned western ewes. The black-faced pole sheep have the shortest legs and the finest wool.
And now to our gospel, but first let John set the scene.
It was the time when the Feast of Dedication was being celebrated in Jerusalem. It was winter, and Jesus was in the temple, walking up and down in the portico of Solomon.
This portico, we're told, was what remained of the original temple building. It ran along the eastern side of the temple court, and its walls, which overhung the valley of Cedron, offered shelter in winter from the violent east winds. The Feast of Dedication, known also as Hanukkah, Feast of Lights, commemorated the re-consecration of the temple after its profanation by King Antiochus IV. And as Jesus walks in that sheltered spot, the Jews gather round him, with that attitude, notes Piero Bargellini, of mingled reverence and hostility, curiosity and diffidence. But they want to know something. There's this rumour that he is the Messiah. Could it possibly be? And so the more timid among them nudge the bolder ones to ask him straight out.
How much longer are you going to keep us in suspense? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly. Jesus replied, I have told you, but you do not believe. The works I do in my Father's name are my witness, but you do not believe, because you are no sheep of mine. The sheep that belong to me listen to my voice. I know them, and they follow me.
I give them eternal life, and they shall never perish, is the promise of our gospel. No one shall snatch them out of my hand. Or in another version, no one will ever steal them from me. In our technological age, the image of stealing a sheep doesn't have the force it would have had in Bible times. or even a mere 200 or 300 years ago. It was a serious offence to steal a sheep. As we know from the old saying, one might as well be hanged for a sheep as a lamb, for hanging was the penalty for sheep stealing. Wrote one N. Rogers in 1662.
Some desperate wretches, despairing of life, still lacked the more villainy, giving this desperate reason of it, as good be hanged for a great deal as for a little.
Back in the Middle Ages, one of the mystery plays, The Second Shepherd's Pageant, combined the serious story of the Nativity with a comic pseudo-nativity involving a stolen sheep. Borrowed from folklore, it recounts how Mac, the sheep stealer, hides a stolen sheep in a cradle, pretending his wife has just given birth. But the shepherds soon discover the trick, and Mac is tossed in a blanket while the sheep is returned to its owner. Probably no other psalm is so well known or so beloved as "The Lord is my shepherd." But let's hear how an old Palestinian shepherd explained it to a traveller in the Holy Land.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want.
Sheep somehow know that before they've been folded for the night, the shepherd has planned out their grazing for the morrow. It may be that he will take them back over the same ranges. It may be that he will go on to a new grazing ground. They don't worry. His guidance has been good in the past, and they have faith in the future, because they know he has their well-being in view.
Fresh and green are the pastures where he gives me repose.
Sheep graze from about 3:30 until 10 o'clock in the morning. They then lie down for 3 or 4 hours and rest. When they are contentedly chewing their cuds, the shepherd knows they are putting on fat. Consequently, the good shepherd starts his flock out on the rough herbage in the early hours, moving through the morning to the richer, sweeter grasses, finally coming to a shady place for the forenoon rest in fine green pastures. Sheep resting in such happy surroundings feel contentment.
Near restful waters he leads me to revive my drooping spirit.
Every shepherd knows that sheep will not drink gurgling water. There are many small springs high in the hills of the Holy Land whose waters run down the valleys only to evaporate in the desert sun. Although the sheep need the water, they will not drink from these fast-flowing streams. The shepherd must find a place where rocks or erosion have made a small pool, or else fashion with his hands a pocket sufficient to hold at least a bucketful.
He guides me along the right path. He is true to his name.
In the Holy Land, each sheep takes its place in the grazing line in the morning and keeps the same position throughout the day. Once during the day, however, each sheep leaves its place and goes to the shepherd. Whereupon the shepherd stretches out his hand and rubs the animal's nose and ears, scratches its chin, whispers affectionately into its ears. The sheep, meanwhile, rubs against his leg, or if the shepherd is sitting down, nibbles at his ear and rubs its cheek against his face. After a few minutes of this communion with its master, the sheep returns to its place in the feeding line.
If I should walk in the valley of darkness, no evil would I fear. You are there, with your crook and your staff. With these, you give me comfort.
There is an actual valley of the shadow of death in Palestine, and every shepherd from Spain to Dalmatia knows of it. It lies south of the Jericho Road, leading from Jerusalem to the Dead Sea. Just a narrow gorge through the mountains. It's 4.5 miles long, with the walls towering 1,500 feet above the floor of the valley, which is only 10 or 12 feet wide. Travel through the valley is dangerous because the floor is broken by gullies, often 7 to 8 feet deep. Footing on solid rock is so narrow in places that a sheep cannot turn round. So it's an unwritten law of the shepherds that sheep must go up the valley in the morning hours and down towards the eventide, lest flocks should meet in the defile. About halfway through the valley, the pathway crosses from one side to the other, at a place where the path is cut in two by an 8-foot gully. One side of the gully is about 18 inches higher than the other. The sheep must jump across it. The shepherd stands at the break and coaxes or forces the sheep to make the leap. If one should slip or land in the gully, the shepherd's rod is brought into play. The old-style crook circles the sheep's neck or a small sheep's chest, and the animal is lifted to safety. If a more modern narrow crook is used, the sheep is caught about the hooves and lifted up to the walk. Many wild dogs lurk in the valley looking for prey. The shepherd, skilled in throwing his staff, uses it as a weapon. Thus the sheep have learned to fear no evil, even in this valley of darkness, for their master is there to protect them from harm.
You have prepared a banquet for me in the sight of my foes.
David's meaning is a simple one, when conditions on the Holy Land sheep ranges are known. Poisonous plants, which are fatal to grazing animals, abound there. Every spring, each shepherd must be constantly alert. When he finds such plants, he takes his mattock and goes on ahead of the flock, grubbing out every stick and root he can see. As he digs up the sticks, he lays them on little stone pyres, some of which were built by shepherds in Old Testament days, and by the next day they are dry enough to burn. Once the pasture is free from poisonous plants, the sheep are led into it, and in the presence of their plant enemies, they eat in peace.
My head you have anointed with oil, my cup is overflowing.
At every sheepfold there is a big earthen bowl of olive oil and a large jar of water. As the sheep come in for the night, they are led to a gate. The shepherd lays his rod across the top of the gate, just above the backs of his sheep. As each passes, he quickly examines it for briars in its ears, snags in the cheek, or weeping of the eyes, caused by dust or scratches. When any such conditions are found, the shepherd drops his rod across the sheep's back, and it steps out of line. Each sheep's wounds are carefully cleaned. Then the shepherd dips his hand into the olive oil and anoints the injury. A large cup is dipped into the jar of water, kept cool by evaporation in the unglazed pottery, and is brought out never half full, but overflowing. The sheep will sink its nose into the water, clear to the eyes, and drink until fully refreshed. When all are at rest, the shepherd replaces his staff within reach against night marauders, wraps himself in his woolen robe, and lies down across the gateway and settles for his night's repose. So, after all the care and protection the shepherd has given it, the sheep may well soliloquize in the twilight, much the same as David did in his psalm.
Surely goodness and kindness shall follow me all the days of my life. In the Lord's own house shall I dwell, forever and ever.
During the past few days, Pope Benedict has reminded us of the importance of giving ourselves to follow Jesus with wholehearted commitment. Joan Lewis and I have more. Well, Joan, as we start today's programme, we're looking back at the Pope's visit to Pavia and Vigevano. We're looking forward to the 43rd World Day of Prayer for Vocations on Sunday. And we're also looking forward to the Pope's visit to Brazil.
with Benedict to look at his agenda before any trip he takes, especially a longer trip. It's very similar to what John Paul II did. He kind of filled his calendar with appointments, meetings, audiences, speeches, homilies, whatever. Before he went to Vigevano, for example, the Friday before, he left on Saturday and spent Saturday night and Sunday in these two northern Italian dioceses. But, I mean, he met with the Sri Lankan president before he left. He met with quite a number of Tuscan bishops and with members of the Papal Foundation. And he was a very, very busy person the day before he left for Pavia. But this was a wonderful trip to the north. The whole theme of it, if you want to say that the Pope had a theme, it really was the defense of life and the defense of the traditional family in his various meetings with people, his homilies.
Which, of course, is looking forward to the theme of his trip to Brazil, isn't it?
Exactly.
The family.
Exactly. And we're going to hear a lot more in Brazil of what we heard over the weekend. Well, Vigevano, you know, was the only diocese in the Lombardy region of Italy that Pope John Paul had not visited. And so that was the first thing that the Pope told them. He said he was very happy to start his pastoral pilgrimage in Vigevano because it was the only one not visited by his predecessor.
And one thing about his time in Pavia, because I did the commentary on the Mass on Sunday morning, he spoke so beautifully about St. Augustine and Augustine's own search for truth.
You could sense in the Holy Father's words exactly how much this saint did mean to him. But no, the Pope's visit was a mixture of things, very colorful, very happy. You could tell the Holy Father was delighted to be there. He got a roaring welcome in both dioceses, and he also got a rousing welcome when he spoke about the traditional families. And he said, only by working in favor of families can the fabric of the ecclesial community and civil society be renewed. Vigevano's really kind of, it's been called by many the shoe capital of Italy. Obviously, the Italians are known for their leather goods, first and foremost, I would say shoes, maybe, and purses together. In any event, a consortium of shoemakers in Vigevano gave the Holy Father 15,001 pair of shoes. The one pair was for him. He got 15,000 pair for the needy. And as soon as the Vatican has lets them know, maybe they've already done it, these shoes, men, women's, children's, all kinds, boots, shoes, whatever, they will be sent to the needy. The Holy Father is very concerned that any gifts given to him can be used by others. Or if you're going to make a donation, make it to a papal charity, to Cor Unum, to the Elemosineria. But he isn't concerned about getting flowers and cakes and other things like that for events for himself. As you said, Sunday then, of course, was dedicated to St. Augustine. He was in Pavia. He was overnighted in Pavia. Sunday was dedicated to St. Augustine. He visited his tomb. And he said, as a matter of fact, that his visit to Pavia was a pilgrimage to venerate the remains of St. Augustine, to show his personal devotion and gratitude to this saint for the large part he played in my life. Of course, Augustine was born in 354 in what's modern-day Algeria. And by the way, he's the patron of theologians, and he died in 430.
Well, Augustine had an amazing influence on the whole of the church, and when you think how early it was in the history of the church that he was actually born, lived, and died.
Sure.
It's quite a lasting effect.
The early part of the 5th century. So,
but there's been another writer, in a sense, that has been in the news this week insofar as the Pope himself wrote a letter to Chancellor Angela Merkel.
Yes, he did. This was revealed. It's actually a December 2006 letter, and her response to the Holy Father dates from February of this year. But the Vatican Monday released the text of letters between the two, and I mean, they're both German, naturally, concerning the agenda of the June meeting in Germany of the G8, which, of course, is the seven leading economic powers plus Russia. And the Chancellor had announced in July 2006 that under her presidency, the G8 would continue to keep the question of global poverty on the agenda, and in particular aid to Africa would be a key priority at the summit, which will take place in Heiligendamm. And so the Holy Father said in his letter, he noted a fact that the German presidency of the G8 coincides with the presidency of the European Union. And he says this is a unique opportunity to tackle this issue of poverty, and welcomed the fact that poverty is high on the agenda of the G8, and said it should be given the highest attention and priority for the sake of rich and poor countries alike. And what I thought was interesting, he said the two of them had met, the Chancellor and the Pope had met last August, and he said, "You assured me that Germany shares the Holy See's concern regarding the inability," I love the choice of that word, "regarding the inability of rich countries to offer the poorest countries financial and trade conditions that would, of course, help their economies." And I think that's an extremely diplomatic word to say their inability, because it certainly is not financial inability. They have the wherewithal.
It's all political will.
It's political will. It's the desire to help. You've got the wherewithal, and you do or you don't use it for the right reasons. So the Pope did mention that the active participation of international partners, by that, of course, he means the rich nations who can help, it's indispensable. And he called it actually a grave and unconditional moral responsibility founded on the unity of the human race and the common dignity and shared destiny of rich and poor alike. So a very important exchange of ideas. And in just kind of checking the international press, the content of those letters was given a lot of attention. So that's a very good thing to note, that unlike some Vatican things, which kind of can pass unnoticed, this was given a lot of attention in the press, and that's a good thing.
And please God, people will act on it.
Indeed.
Of course.
We have one other important...
Definitely.
Before we close, I think we might want to mention that the Holy Father this week met with Mahmoud Abbas, president of the Palestinian Authority, for a 15-minute private encounter. And, of course, there was a statement from the press office that said the talks were cordial. Naturally, a particular appreciation on the part of the Vatican was expressed for the commitment to relaunch the peace process between Israelis and Palestinians. And the Pope and Abbas also talked about the internal Palestinian situation with reference to particular difficulties faced by Christians and in particular by Catholics. And of course, the Pope in his Easter message, and that wasn't that long ago, spoke of what he called signs of hope in the Middle East, in the peace process between the Israelis and the Palestinians. So we shall see if that works out. Now, Abbas, he's also known as Abu Mazen. He also met with Cardinal Secretary of State. And interestingly enough, he heads this unity government that's formed by the Fatah movement, his own party, the militant Hamas, and then by independence. And he's trying to garner support for his government, and Abbas, therefore, is traveling all around Europe. So a potentially very important meeting, certainly for Abbas and the Palestinians, if he relays the Holy Father's message to the leaders in the Middle East.
So, next week.
On that note.
And so we come to the end of our program for today. You can hear it all again in whole or in its parts if you go to our website at www.vaticanradio.org/English. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. Until we meet again, may God bless you.
This is Vatican Radio, Laudato Jesus Christus.